Reading from the Seventh Goswami, a biography of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Oh, I promised Hansapriya I would record this. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Family lineage. Srila Sakchidananda Bhaktivinoda Thakur was born on September 2nd, 1838, on Sunday, in the ancient village of Birnagar, Ulagram, or Ula, located in the Nadia district of West Bengal. Nadia ki? He was the third son of Ananda Chandra Datto and Jagat Mohini Devi. It can be said that he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, as both his mother and father came from illustrious and wealthy families. However, he suffered great miseries and trials throughout his youth. He was given the name of Kedarnath, a name of Lord Shiva, by his father. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote a book in 1876 called Datta Vangshamala, in which he detailed the genealogy of his father's family line. He also explains in his autobiography, quote, I was born a descendant of Purushottama Datto, a Kanyakubja Kayasta, among the five Kayastas who came to the Gota region at the invitation of King Adisura, namely Makarananda Ghosh, Dasarath Vasu, Kalidas Mitra, Dasarath Guha, and Purushottam Datto. Sri Purushottam Datto was the foremost. His community was settled in Baligram. Later on, some individual in his lineage settled in Adulagram and became known as the chief of all the Kayasta community. Unquote. Also in his line was Raj Krishnananda Datto, the father of the great Vaishnavacharya Narottam Das Thakur and a great devotee of Lord Nityananda, and who was often received that Lord in his home. Kedarnath was thus later called the seventh son of Raj Krishnananda. Raj Krishnananda's grandson was Govinda Charan Datto. The Sultan of Delhi once gave Govinda Charan some land on the banks of the Ganges in West Bengal. On that land, Govinda Charan established the town of Govindapur. This town was later joined with two neighboring towns, Kaligat and Sutanuti, to form the city now known as Calcutta, a city of tremendous importance to the British Empire. When the British built Fort William at Govindapur, Govind Charan and his family were given land in exchange, and the Datto family moved to Hatkola, where they began a settlement and became known as Hatkola Dattas. Govinda Charan's grandson was Ramachandra Datto, whose son, Krishna Chandra, was a great Vaishnav. Krishna Chandra's son was the famous Vaishnav, Madan Mohan Datto, who was a contemporary of Lord Clive and a merchant and zamindar in Calcutta. He was famous in Bengal for constructing 395 stone steps at Prestashila Hill at Gaya, where the impression of the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu are enshrined, at a cost of hundreds of thousands of rupees, so that the pilgrims could climb the sacred hill. The lotus feet of the Lord at Gaya were the meeting place of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Nishvarapuri, and where Lord Chaitanya experienced deep ecstasy after seeing the Lord's feet. Madan Mohan's son was Ramtanu Datto, and his son was Rajabalab Datto, the paternal grandfather of Kedarnath. He possessed mystic powers and could foretell the future. In his autobiography, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes his father and mother in the following manner. My father, Ananda Chandra Datto Mahashaya, was very religious, straightforward, and detached from sensual things. Regarding his beauty, many people used to say that in Calcutta there was no one at that time who was as handsome. My mother was called Srimati Jagat Mohini. She was possessed of intellect, straightforwardness, and devotion to my father. It can be said that there was no one like her. His mother was the daughter of Ishwar Chandra Mitra Mushtap Taupi, a descendant of the noble Rameshwar Mitra Mushtap Taupi family. Her father was a man of immense wealth and generous disposition. As a generous zamindar, of the West Bengal district of Nadia. He was held next in esteem to the king of Nadia. Kedarnath's paternal grandmother was the daughter of Roy Ryan Jagannath Prasad Ghosh, who owned property in the district of Cuttack in the state of Orissa. The village known as Choti Govindapur is situated on the bank of the Virupa River, as well as other villages were their family property. However, Kedarnath's paternal grandmother and grandfather were living in Calcutta at the time of Roy Ryan's death, and the property fell into the hands of Roy Ryan's chief servant named Ramahari, who took possession of everything. Therefore, Kedarnath's paternal grandfather and grandmother, who were destitute in Calcutta, were there to reclaim their property. But the rascal, Ramahari, would not give it up. A lawsuit was started, and Anandachandra, at the request of his father, went to Orissa to settle the case, which took almost 3 years. When his paternal grandfather and grandmother moved from Calcutta to Orissa, Anandachandra and Jagat Mohini went to her ancestral home, taking Abhaya Kali, their firstborn, with them. Shortly after their arrival, their second son, Kali Prasanna, was born, and then Anandachandra went to Orissa to help his father secure the ancestral lands. The birth and infancy of Bhaktivinoda. During the time his father was away, Kedarnath was born in Bir Nagar, Ulagram, Ula. At the time of his birth, an astrologer sat marking the time with an hourglass, and an English account of the time was also kept. Kedarnath was born in the time of the British East India Company's ascendancy. The last powerful Muslim ruler, Shah Alam, had lived only to see the troops of the British East India Company march into Delhi in 1803. In the first half of the 19th century, a number of wars of conquest were waged by the British. The Marathas, who had previously become very powerful under their king, Shivaji, were crushed in three grueling wars. Their confederacy was thus broken, and with it any hopes for self-rule by 1818. From 1818 to 1857, during the time Kedarnath came of age and was educated, the British fought a number of wars of annexation, and by 1857, almost two-thirds of the subcontinent had fallen to them. Bengal, and especially Calcutta, was a hub of the East India Company's trading operation. Kedarnath's maternal grandfather, an aristocratic landholder, was fabulously wealthy. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes in his autobiography, "My maternal grandfather had incomparable wealth and a grand estate. There were hundreds of male and female servants. When I was born, I was a good weight. I had an older brother, Abhaya Kali, who had previously died, and a second brother, Kali Prasanna, who was still living. I was my father's third son. It was said that of all my brothers, I was a little ugly. But my mother said, 'Very well, let this boy be the servant of the rest. Just let him live a long time.' My mother told me that when I was 8 months old, I got a boil on my thigh, and as a result, it became weak and emaciated. I also heard that while I was being carried in the arms of my nurse, Shibu, down a flight of stairs, I cut my tongue on my own teeth. To this day, I have a scar on my tongue. This happened around the time my teeth were coming in. When the boy was almost 2 years old, his father returned from Orissa. His nurse later told him that a few days before his return, the boy saw a crow flying to a perch, and he composed a rhyme. Kuk kal jingerapul baba aseta nadi baso. O crow, kal, flower of the jinga squash, father comes, sit aside. As he spoke, the crow changed his position. Some people nearby noticed this and said, "Oh, your father must certainly be coming soon." His father arrived a few days later. This is the biography of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And I also have a book called Vani Vaibhava, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Vani Vaibhava. So I was going to interchange a little bit because it's a long haul to, get up to to go through the whole biography, which I may do during the week. But I also want to read some of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's prominent teachings, which are in this book. Chapter 1, Relationship with the Lord. What is the science or knowledge of one's relationship with the Supreme Lord? Hare Krishna. There are three truths regarding one's relationship with the Lord. These are knowledge about the material world, knowledge about the living entities, and knowledge about the Supreme Lord. What is that called, that kind of knowledge? Sambandha. Sambandha Gyan. The Supreme Lord is one without a second, omnipotent, all-attractive, the source of all opulence and sweetness, and the only shelter of the living entities and material nature. Although he is the shelter of the living entities and material nature, he is always fully independent. His bodily effulgence is known as the impersonal Brahman. He creates the living entities and the material world by his spiritual potency, and then as Paramatma, a plenary portion, he entered into the universes. So what's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita that explains how Krishna is the basis of the impersonal Brahman? Akurnath Prabhu. And use the microphone too. Can you tell us where the verse is and expound on it, please?
I think it's the last verse of the 14th chapter. Am I right?
Yes.
And, you know, throughout the chapter, Lord Krishna has been describing the three modes of material nature, and then Arjuna asks him, you know, how does one overcome the three modes of material nature? And Krishna says, you know, by engaging constantly in devotional service without any deviation, then one, you know, becomes to the level of Brahma Bhuta. And then he says, then, and I am the basis of that. You know, I am the basis of Brahman. And sukhasya ikantikasya, it's joyful. I have to read it, actually. Oh, I've got one on my thing. And I am the basis of that imperishable Brahman.
Immortal, imperishable.
Imperishable. Oh, thank you. And I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman, which is immortal, imperishable, and eternal, and is the constitutional position of ultimate happiness.
Thank you. And who can give some logic explaining logic, not Shastra necessarily, which one could give to a layperson to express that God is a person, that there's a supreme person who's the source of all other things? What is a logical way to explain that? Kurnath Prabhu, you're out for one round. Okay, everybody. Give me logic. Logic, no Shastra, just logic. Logic that God is a person. Is a person. God is a person, and I want the logic expressing how he's a person.
If we start extrapolating on the six opulences, like who's the richest, who's the most beautiful, who's the most wealthy, and that we will come to that one person who has all of them.
Do you buy that, Karna? We'll be our judge. You do? Okay.
Someone is rich and someone is more rich and someone is more rich than that, that you have to be able to find ultimately who is the most rich. And similarly with beautiful and renounced and knowledgeable and so forth. And, you know, assuming they're all the same person, I would have to say that person would be God.
Okay.
Aside from the fact that Parashara Muni has given that definition of Bhagavan, so that I buy it. I know it's not. I know what you're looking for.
You're an easy sell. Okay, go ahead. Logic a layperson on the street could understand.
Well, the fact that living entities are persons, and they have emanated from a creator, the seed-giving father, then he must be a person. We have been made in his, we are a part and parcel of him, we are fragments of him. So he has to be a personality. He cannot be impersonal if we are persons. We are Purusha, so we have come from the super Purusha, if you will.
That's nice. Can anybody continue that a little bit? Go ahead, Akarna.
When something comes from something else, the origin has all the qualities that all the qualities of the effect are present in the cause. So the question then arises: is being a person having more qualities than being not a person? And I think anyone fairly considering it, especially if they don't limit the idea of person to having to be a limited person, although most of the persons in our experience are limited persons. But we have to understand that if I can have desires, and if I can have thoughts, and if I can have intentions, and if I can have relationships, then I have something more than a non-person, like a stone or a machine, or even like the impersonal Brahman, a concept of that which is unmanifested and transcendental and everywhere. That I still have more than that. I have something that doesn't have. If that doesn't have hands and feet and senses and consciousness or awareness, ability to discriminate and all those other things, then I have more than it has. Of course, I don't have more than it has because it's more unlimited. But there has to be some unlimited person from which that has arisen, because otherwise we see personality in creation in ourselves. So following up on Rakshit's, we have to have emanated from something that has those qualities in them.
Very nice. So this logic we're following probably gives in a simple way. He says, if you look at the genealogy of any person, like we were just talking about the genealogy of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and you can follow it back, one father, another father, another father, set of parents, they go back, they're all personal. And similarly in history, kings all had genealogy. Common people didn't keep that so much. But if you follow back any king and you keep going, who was the father of the father of the father, you always find that there was a previous father. So Prabhupada's logical point is, you follow that back all the way, then you come back to the original person. There's no point at which a person emanated from an impersonal source. And that person, according to Shastra, which backs up the logic, oh, what a disaster. Could I buy you a Haida key on your way home? Can you come back?
I could. Although by the time I'm there and I'm back, yeah.
We'll slow down. Hare Krishna.
I think I do have some things to do.
All right. So you gave us a taste and now you're leaving.
You gave me a taste.
Hare Krishna. We were just saying that Prabhupada had summed it up by saying, if you follow the genealogical table of any person, they have a father who has a father who has a father, father. You follow that all the way back and you'll find that there's a supreme father. Simple.
Aristotle also argued that, that every effect has, every motion, every action has some mover. So there has to be an original mover that put all things into motion.
Sarva Karana Karanam. Supreme cause of all causes. Thank you very much. Akarna Prabhu is leaving. Haribo! So, from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings, we're counting down the days until the disappearance of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which is on the 11th, next Sunday. It's the day we celebrate here at ISV by distributing mass quantities of books. So,
Why do we celebrate somebody's disappearance? In the sense that we should be feeling bad that he went back, or we should be feeling good that he went back?
Well, it's bittersweet. On the disappearance day of a Vaishnav, it's bittersweet because we lament the fact that we don't have the Vapu association of such a person. But we celebrate the fact that the Vaishnav has gone into Nitya Lila with the Lord, or is somewhere else assisting others in going back home, back to Godhead. Reasons ill who tells that Vaishnavs die, for Vaishnavs die to live, and living try to spread the holy name around. So Vaishnavs never die. They go on to other situations where they're doing their glorious activities of preaching or engaging in service to the Lord directly. So we do lament on that day, though. There was a song, a very melancholy song that we sing, Yeyanilo Premadana. And it's a song where we lament the loss of the association of a great personality, of a great Vaishnav. And in fact, it's true. When Ramananda Roy was speaking with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and Mahaprabhu asked Ramananda Roy, what is the greatest kind of suffering in this world? Ramananda Roy answered, I know of no other kind of suffering equal to that of losing the association of a Vaishnav. So, yeah, we lament, but at the same time, all the activities of a Vaishnav are glorious. So we also celebrate. His bodily effulgence, Krishna's bodily effulgence, is known as the impersonal Brahman. He created the living entities in the material world by his spiritual potency, and then as Paramatma, a plenary portion, he entered into the universes. In his form of opulence, or Aishvarya, he is Lord Narayan in the spiritual sky. In his form of sweetness, or Madhurya, he is Sri Krishna Chandra, the beloved Lord of the gopis in Goloka Vrindavan. His manifestations and pastimes are unlimited. There is nothing greater than or equal to him. All his forms and pastimes manifest through his internal spiritual potency, through his internal spiritual energy. The living entities are aware of the three energies among the many potencies of the Lord. One is his spiritual energy, by which all his pastimes take place. Another is his marginal energy, the living entities, by which unlimited living entities are produced and sustained. The other is his external energy, Maya, by which all material objects, time, and activities are created. Sambandha Tattva refers to the following relationships. The living entities toward the Supreme Lord toward the living entities and the material world, and the material world toward the Supreme Lord and the living entities. If one properly understands Sambandha Tattva, one becomes acquainted with knowledge of one's relationship with the Supreme Lord. Persons who are devoid of knowledge of their relationship with the Supreme Lord can never become pure Vaishnavas. So Sambandha Tattva, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has also spoken about this in the Harinam Chintamani. And this is the essential beginning point for spiritual life, to know one's relationship. It's compared to looking at a map and finding out the point at which you are at the present time. You are here. And once you orient yourself on the map, then you know how far you have to go. You know which way to move and how to react and then move in the world. So Sambandha Gyan also changes our relationship with the world as it is. And a logical example is when you're driving on the freeway, and some people, they become angry when they're driving because maybe people are not such courteous drivers. And maybe somebody cuts in front of you on the freeway. Has that happened to anyone here? All the time? So in such cases, you can imagine that if someone is very a rude driver and cuts you off and endangers your life, you might feel a sudden flare of anger. It's possible. It could happen. Is it possible? Could it happen that you'd feel some angst or even anger? It's possible. Okay, so now what if you became angry at that person, and then all of a sudden you realized that it was actually your grandmother was driving? Would that change the equation? Say you felt angry and you were about to honk the horn and say, you know, you almost killed me, you know. But then you looked and you recognized that actually that was my grandmother. And, you know, I know her vision's not very good. She may not get her next driver's license. But, you know, she's trying to go drive to the temple and she accidentally cut me off. She didn't know what she was doing. Would it change how you felt towards her? Would the anger go away? So knowledge of relationship changes everything. If we understand our relationship with someone, it's not impersonal, then suddenly our feeling towards that person will go away. Another example is if you see somebody drop a $100 bill, you actually see them drop it. You're in line at a store. So now immediately there's a feeling that you should give it back to them. And the feeling, if you kept the $100 bill, would be much more pronounced that you're actually stealing something. And you'd look around to see if any cameras were going or if anybody was behind you watching. And you would probably feel guilty when you went home and be hard to go to sleep. And all this is because you actually saw the relationship between the $100 bill and the person who owned it. However, if you were walking in the parking lot of the supermarket and you just found a $100 bill on the ground, you would not have those similar feelings. You wouldn't have to deal with those feelings at all. You just pick it up and say, as we used to say as kids, finders keepers, losers weepers. Because how are you going to return a $100 bill? It's very difficult. But if you see where it came from, then your feelings and your responsibility are immediate. So similarly with Sambandh again, we understand where everything comes from. Aham sarvasya pravavo matak sarvam pravartate iti matva abhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. 10:8. One of the nutshell verses of the Bhagavad Gita in which Krishna says how knowing that he's the source of everything changes everything. Iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. A person who understands that everything comes from Krishna, everything, has no anxiety and becomes a lover of the Lord. It's also expressed in the Sri Upanishad. Yas tu sarvani bhutani atmani vanu pashyati sarva bhuteshu chatmanam tato na vijugupsate. One who sees all living entities as spiritual sparks in quality one with the Lord becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? Yasmin sarvani bhutani atmai vadbud vijanataha tatrako mahakashoka ekatvam manupashita. One who sees everything in relationship to the Supreme Lord and sees all living entities as his parts and parcels never hates anything or any being. I reversed the order of the translations. So the last translation went with the first verse I quoted, just for the record. But those two verses point out that when one knows everyone's and everything's relationship to Krishna, then he or she is no longer in anxiety about anything and no longer hates anything or any being. And the quality of hatred or desire that a person is born with, Krishna says, in this world, icha dvesha sumutena dvandva mohena bharata. Sarva bhutani sammoham sargayanti parantapa. He says everyone's born in with these emotions, desire and hatred. So sambandha gyan, sambandha tattva, means understanding what is my relationship with Krishna and what is Krishna's relationship to me. So what is my relationship to Krishna summed up in one word? Servant. This is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught to Sanatana Goswami. We're the eternal servants of Krishna. And what is Krishna's relationship to us? Father, master? So the servant and the master. And of course, in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, we go further than that because in most philosophical, religious understandings, we're the sons of God. But actually, who does more service for whom? Does the Father do more service for the Son, or the Son do more for service for the Father? Anybody have experience? Does the mother do more service for the Son, or does the Son do more service for the mother? Can you tell us? I would think that you are absolutely correct. Okay. What would you say? Who does more service? Does this daughter or... Huh? One can only hope, right? So, yes.
It's the mother, of course. And one of my friends once commented that it's a river that flows in one direction only, the river of service, from the mother to the daughter, from the daughter to her daughter. Mm. Like, you know, that's how the service flows, and not it doesn't come back.
I see. It doesn't come back. So, in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, we actually, the relationship is that the devotee relishes having Krishna as his son or her son, because that way they can do unlimited service. Just coming from Sankirtan? Okay.
Almost.
Oh, that's good. Same thing. That is Sankirtan. Samyak Kirtan. Hare Krishna. So, yes. Well, yes, that's the basis. Yeah, in understanding Sambandha Tattva, we're the servant, Krishna is the master. We are the fed, he is the feeder. Who's feeding all the mouths in the world? How many mouths do you think there are to feed today on this planet? Not just humans, but all, count all deer, all giraffes, all elephants, all dogs, all ants, all flies, all bees. Okay, count all insects, all reptiles, aquatics, and human beings, all mammals. How many mouths would you say there are to feed today?
It goes over 800,046,000 or so. There is some number like that.
Okay.
Or 8,046,000 different species.
Oh, species. 8,400,000 species of life. Yeah. But I'm asking how many actually mouths there are. Yeah, how many ants are on the planet today? Can you tell us? Can you Google that? How many ants, and then add in all mammals, all humans? Huh? A few billion? Zillions?
It would go into trillions.
Okay, they're all hungry too, right? They all have a metabolism. They got to eat something, don't they? Who's feeding them? Can you prove it? Shastrically? Who's feeding all those mouths? Teach us. Can you use the microphone? Just belt out what you know, like you really know it.
Nitya nityanam chetanas chetananam eko bahunam.
Yo vididhati kaman.
Yo vididhati kaman.
Bravo. Way to go. So you can look that verse up. It's in your shloka book.
Prabhuji, yeah. I also wanted to comment that just today in the morning, I found, and I was thinking about the same thing that you mentioned, I found a very tiny little silver fish in one of the bathroom mats. It was very, very tiny. And for other animals, one can think that, you know, the birds, they go to the trees and they eat, and elephants, you know, they eat, and the tigers eat other animals. So they are somehow equipped. But the tiny little silver fish in the bathroom mat, you know, from where does that little insect get the food? It's amazing. I was very, very amazed in the morning just thinking about that, you know, Krishna provides.
Yeah, and Krishna arranges to feed them all. Rakshit Prabhu, what page is that on? Page 360 of the Shloka book, Hare Krishna. Page 360, and we have the verse which we will recite together from the Katha Upanishad 2.2.13. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam eko bahunam yo viditati kaman. Now I'll say the word and then please repeat. Nityaha, the singular eternal. Nityanam, of the plural eternals. Chetanaha, the singular conscious being. Chetananam, of the plural conscious beings. Ekaha, that one. Bahunam, of the many. Ya, hihu. Vidhati, supplies. Kaman, all desired necessities of life. Translation: the Supreme Lord is eternal, and the living entities are eternal. The Supreme Lord. Okay, go ahead. The Supreme Lord is cognizant, and the living beings are cognizant. The difference is that the Supreme Lord is supplying all the necessities of life for the many other living entities. Now, that's Shastric, but you can also, anyone can look around and discover that for themselves. Are you feeding all the ants in the world? Elephants? It's hard enough even if you have one child or one pet, right? To feed one mouth. What to speak of feed your own mouth? And so all these things are being done by the immense potencies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So our relationship is that we are the fed, he is the feeder. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam. Eko bahunam yo vidhati kaman. And this is one way of consciously connecting to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Aham vaishva naro bhutva praninam deham ashrita. Remembering that whenever we receive food, that's coming by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If water, rasoham apsakonteya, that when we get water and our thirst is quenched, that quenching power coming from the water, that's from Krishna, as he says in Bhagavad Gita. And the power of digestion, that is coming from Krishna also. And the food itself is coming from Krishna. So we can remember this is part of sammanda tattva, remembering who is the feeder and who is the fed. And if we remember that one thing, how Krishna is feeding all living entities, he's feeding me, I'm fully dependent on him, then this, knowing that we're dependent, knowing that we're the servant, then we can act correctly and move in this world in the correct way. It's the right relationship. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur has expressed this as a beginning, an essential aspect from his Jiva Dharma. He next says, is the feeling of I and mine in relationship with the Lord abominable? The feeling of I and mine in connection with one's relationship with Krishna is not born of material pride, rather it is born from one's service attitude. So this means that there's a false ego, and we have a real ego. It's not that because I have a false ego, through which I connect to this temporary material world and therefore suffer because of my identification with it, as described by Maitreya to Vidura. He said, sometimes in a dream, you'll see that your head is being cut off and you're watching. And you'll suffer in the dream. Think, no, stop, please. But actually, this is a fallacy. You can't watch your own head being cut off because your head's being cut off, the optical nerve is cut, everything. So similarly, material life, because of my false identification with it and with this material body, then I suffer because that's not the fact. The body's a changing vehicle that I'm in. But that sense of connection, it's not that it is eliminated altogether, but it's transferred to the feeling of Krishna is mine. I'm his eternal servant. That's real ego. The serving ego, that I am Krishna's eternal servant. And in Vrindavan, the devotees have a very strong feeling of mamata. Mamata, Krishna is mine. That actually he's my child. And they're very much attached to him and thinking of them as of Krishna as theirs in a possessive way. This is an advanced stage of devotional service. This is the real ego, because this is our eternal condition, our eternal position as servants and lovers of Krishna. Next, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, what is Amnaya? Amnaya is Vedic literature consisting of spiritual knowledge received through the disciplic succession coming from Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe. Number two, what are the basic teachings of Sri Chaitanya Dev? Sri Hari is the supreme absolute truth. He is omnipotent. He is the nectarian ocean of transcendental mellows. The living entities are his separated parts and parcels. The conditioned souls are controlled by Maya, whereas the liberated souls are free from Maya. Both the spiritual and material worlds are simultaneously one with and different from Sri Hari. Devotional service is the only way to obtain the goal of life, and love of God is the ultimate goal of life. That's from the Sujjana Toshini. Okay, so what are the basic teachings of Sri Chaitanya Dev? Let's go over a few of them. The ultimate goal of life is love of God. Prema Pumarto Mahan. People have many different kinds of objectives in life. For Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha. Means performing religious activities to get economic gain. And after economic gain, there's sense gratification. And after that, one wants liberation. Because there's misery involved. Prema Pumarto Mahan. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught the ultimate goal of life is to attain prema, attain love for Krishna. This is the perfection of life. And in fact, one doesn't need to change any position. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his Shikshashtaka says, na dhanam na janam na sundarim kavitam va jagadisha kamaye mama janmani janmanishvare bhavatad bhaktira hai tuki twai. He says, I don't want wealth, I don't want followers, I don't want beautiful husband or wife. All I want is life after life. I don't want liberation even, he says. All I ask for is your loving devotional service, life after life. Narayana paraksarve nakutaschana bibhiti swarga pavarga narakeshu apituliana darshanaha. The Vaishnav doesn't care whether he or she is in heaven or hell, whatever situation, as long as the connection of service is there to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Devotee is satisfied and happy. Prema Pumarto Mahan, the ultimate goal of life is pure love for God. What are the other basic teachings of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu?
Also, that Lord Hari is the Supreme Master.
That's right. Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Param Sada Pashanti Suryoho Diviva Chakshra Tatam Tad Biprasa Vipanyavo Jagrahansas Mindate Vishnu Yat Paramam Param. The Rig Veda says that the supreme goal of life are the lotus feet of Lord Hari. And those great sages who walk in this world, the devotees, their aim has nothing to do with anything in this world. They're looking upward towards the lotus feet of Lord Hari. So it's good to define the goal, isn't it? This confusion in life comes from lack of a goal and also from lack of a proper goal. Na te vidu swartakatim hi vishnum. Prahlad Maharaj said that the difficulty people have is they don't know that the goal of life is Vishnu. So having a goal is important, and having the right goal is supremely important. So knowing that Lord Hari is our goal, that's important. So that's another tenet. So pure love for God is the goal of life, and that the supreme absolute truth is Lord Hari. What else? What about Lord Hari? What does he say? One of the aspects of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings. What's his nature? Omnipotence. Means he has unlimited potencies. The definition of God, according to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is that he has immense potencies, unlimited potencies. Inconceivable potencies the Supreme Lord has. This is the meaning that he can do anything at any time. And he's not restricted by time, space, circumstances. He can produce universes. He can wind them back up. He's in full control of all of his energies, and they're immense. Parasha Shakti Vividai Vishuyate. So Bhavita Jnana Bala Kriyacha. All his energies are working in magnificent ways. He has variegated energies. Name some of his potencies. So his senses, his limbs are interchangeable for all purposes. Can you give the shastra behind that? And let's we have two microphones in here. Let's keep them circulating because this, whatever you say, is being broadcast and recorded. And you got to turn it on too. Make sure it's on.
Angani asya saklendriya vrittimanti paschanti panti palayanti
chiram jaganti ananda chinmaya sadujvala vigrahasya
govinda madhi purusham tamham bhajam.
And where's that from?
Brahma Samhita.
So, and the meaning is?
That, I just know the gist of the meaning. I don't
give
know
the gist.
That Lord's senses are completely potent and any of his senses can do activities of all the other senses.
Very nice. Very good. Nice quotation for potencies of the Lord. What else? Let's hear what else you have to say about the unlimited potencies of the Lord. Either shlokas or evidence of his unlimited potencies.
He can expand himself in an unlimited into an unlimited numbers.
Okay.
And examples of those are in addition to Anirudh, Pradyum, those kind of. Also, when he was here performing his Leela, he had 16,000 wives and he had expanded himself into so many numbers.
So when Narada went to see Krishna and Dwarka, he went from palace to palace. So Krishna had 16,108 wives, correct? Now, each wife didn't have to wait 16,108 days to see Krishna. Rather, he duplicated himself into 16,108 Krishnas. Now, yogis can also duplicate themselves, but only up to about 9 times. And all of the forms do the same thing. But Krishna, when Narada went from home to home, he saw was performing different kinds of activities. In one place, he was playing with his children, and they were riding on his back like a horse. In some place, he was planning some kind of military operation. In another place, he was dallying with his wife. And each one of the palaces that Narada went to, he was amazed to see the same Krishna but engaged in a different activity. Can someone give Shastra to say how Krishna is expanding himself? Go ahead. Okay, that's the right verse. Ramadi Muti Shukalanya Mena Tishtan. Nana avataram akaro bhuvaneshu kintu. Krishna swayam samababhat parama pumanyo govindamari purusham damam jam. Again, from Brahma Samhita. Lord Brahma says, Ramari murti shukala niyamena tishtan nana avataram akaro bhuvaneshu. That unlimited expansions of Krishna are coming. He's expanding himself in many, many different avatars and forms. And Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, first. Go ahead, you got another one. Yes.
Actually, he was expanding like cows and cows. Like when Brahma steals all the cows, he was expanding like all the cows.
Yes, and boys too, right?
Yeah, cows and boys.
Brahma stole away because he was thinking, is this my Lord? This is the all-opulent personality of Godhead acting like a little cowherd boy? And he was sitting, eating with his left hand, and there's all the... He was some playing with his friends, putting food in their mouth, taking it back out, and they were thinking, this is God? So he thought he'd test him to see if he really had these powers, you know, was he all potent? And he stole away his friends, and he stole away the calves that had wandered away. And then Krishna, he recreated all the boys and all the calves. But now they were Vishnu forms, but they looked exactly like the boys and the calves. And when they went home, the mothers of those boys became 10 times more affectionate towards them. And the calves had already been weaned off. They were at an age where they had been weaned away from taking the milk directly from their mothers. But the cows were on top of the hill. When they saw their calves at the bottom of the hill, they came running down the hill, bounding down the hill to meet up with their calves, and they began licking them out of affection. Balaram knew something was going on. He looked and said, Krishna's up to something again. Because Balaram knows, he knows Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God. Of course, in Vraj, everyone's knowledge of Krishna as the Supreme Personality of God is covered because of his yogamaya potency, because it blocks their natural affection for Krishna. But Balaram thought, you know, Krishna, something's going on here. And then when Brahma came back, he was bewildered when he saw that all the boys and all the calves were again manifest there, but he had just stolen them, and he became confused. And then Krishna revealed how each one of them was actually a Vishnu expansion that had emanated from his immense potencies. Nice. Good example. So Krishna has unlimited potencies. What other examples do you have? Govardhan Hill, for how long? But he needed a crane or something, right? He hired a construction company to come in, and right? With just one little finger. He went into one cave on Govardhan Hill, came underneath, and lifted up the hill. And he stood there. It's the one pastime in which Krishna relates to all the devotees all at the same time, because they all wanted to be with Krishna at the same time. So under Govardhan Hill, it was like a 10-star hotel under there. You know, 5-star hotel, right? This was a 10-star hotel. It wasn't dark and damp and wet like underneath a mountain, but Krishna made it like a beautiful palace down there. There were eating places and stairways and all the things that all the residents of Vrindavan. And Indra, he had become clouded by envy, because every year in Vrindavan, the simple cowherd men and women would perform an Indra Yajna. Because after all, their cows are the most important thing. They're the center of all the culture. And they needed grasses and green things to eat. So that comes from Indra, because the rains, right? So they would worship Indra every year, and the rains would come. They would do ritualistically every year. But one year, while they were getting ready for the yajna, they had all the paraphernalia. They were just getting ready to do their yearly yajna, like people are doing the 4th of July tonight. Because you have to do it. If you're an American, you have to celebrate 4th of July. And so they were getting ready to do their Indra Yajna, and little Krishna walked up to Nanda Maharaj, and he said, "Why are you doing this?" And his father was charmed. His little son was asking him about the yajna. So he started explaining how Indra brings the rain, and we have to worship him. And Krishna said, "The rain falls on the ocean anyway. What's the difference? You know, he gives here, there, another place." And besides, he started speaking of karma mimamsa philosophy, that just if Indra, the rain is, they're obligated to give anyway. So you don't need to perform this yajna. And he said, besides, Govardhan Hill, it's waterfalls, all the grasses are coming from the hill. And forget this Indra. Don't do the Indra yajna. Just take all the paraphernalia that you're going to use for worshiping Indra, take it over and worship the hill. And Nanda Maharaj was convinced. So he told everyone, he was the king of all the cowherd men, so he said, let's not do Indra Yajna, let's worship Govardhan Hill. And when Indra found out that his yajna wasn't going to be taking place, he became so angry that he lost his intelligence. And he sent huge storms to punish the residents of Vrindavan for their insubordination. And just as the rains began to fall, Krishna lifted up the hill and told all the residents to come under the hill to be protected. So everyone came under the hill. And Indra sent his most severe rain clouds and storms and thunderbolts, everything to come and pound the hill. And when his messengers came back, he would ask them, how is the fight going on? And they would say, not one drop has touched anyone in Vrindavan. Not one hair is out of place on one cow in all of Vrindavan, even with the severest storms that were going on. So we became very frustrated. And at one point, Indra brought his own thunderbolt weapon, which is very powerful. And during that time, a demon came to Indra and said, "Very good, you're doing a great job." And Indra began to think, "What am I doing? The demons are on my side. Did I do something wrong?" Finally, after 7 days of torrential rain, he began to realize his folly, that the insurmountable power of Krishna, how he had lifted that hill, Not a drop, not even a hair was out of place. And he had sent devastating rains to wash everybody away. Krishna protected everyone. Then, after Krishna put the hill down, Indra began to lament and think, what did I do? And after being very morose, he went to Brahma, because he knew Brahma had stolen away the cows and calves. And he went to Brahma and said, I've made a big offense to Krishna. I tried to kill all the residents and all the cows, everything. And Brahma said, I know I made something, but not like that. I can't help you. I can't tell you anything. All I did was steal away a few cows and boys. I didn't try to kill them. So then Indra went and he asked Surabhi, the celestial cow, to come with him. And he pushed her in front because Krishna loves cows so much. And Surabhi offered prayers to Krishna and appeased him in that way. And actually, on the back of his elephant, you know, Indra rides on an elephant, Aravata. So Aravata, along with Surabhi, they made an Abhishek. Aravata, with his trunk, he was pouring the milk and bathed Krishna. And there are many kuns all the way around Govardhan Hill that came from this bathing ceremony that took place because of Indra. But the insurmountable potencies of Krishna are there. The residents of Vrindavan, however, they don't see them because of yogamaya potency. When the incomparable potencies of Krishna come out, then it separates him from his devotees. An example is Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Krishna, before the battle, revealed his universal form. And Arjuna is a friend of Krishna. You know, friends, they'll ride in the same car and sit together, eat together, lie in the same bed, talk, make jokes at each other's expense, things like that. And that's what Arjuna and Krishna had in their kind of friendship. But when he saw the universal form of Krishna, he repented. He said, oh, you're God. I made so many offenses to you. Please forgive me. And so that sweet relationship, the friendship relationship, became temporarily dislocated. So in Vrindavan, in the Vraj, devotees see, but they don't see. Even Mother Yashoda, when she looks in the mouth of Krishna, she got a rumor. It was being passed around. They came running to her and said, Krishna ate dirt. He's eating dirt right now. And Mother Yashoda said, where is he? She says, he's eating dirt. So she ran to get Krishna and picked him up, said, you're eating dirt? He said, I didn't eat dirt. If you think I eat dirt, look in my mouth. So she sat him down and said, open your mouth. And so he opened his mouth and she looked in. And what did she see? She saw all the immense potencies of the Lord emanating from the Supreme Personality of God. She saw herself sitting there holding Krishna on her lap. And see all the planetary systems and how they were moving, time, space, living entities. And momentarily she was in awe looking into Krishna's mouth. And then she okay, close your mouth, it's okay. Forget it. Okay, let's go home. And immediately, because of yogamaya potency, she didn't respond to that, because it separates the devotee from the sweet relationship, the close relationship with Krishna. So Krishna has immense potencies, and this is one aspect of knowing the Supreme Personality of God. The impersonalists, they say God has no potencies. This is the difference. For the personalists said God has unlimited potencies, and for the impersonalists, they say God has no potencies. It's all impersonal. To have potencies, one must have personal force. What is another aspect of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teaching according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur? Sri Hari is the supreme absolute truth. We heard that one. He is omnipotent. Devotional service is the pure love for God is the ultimate goal of life. What else? Yes?
Something was simultaneously one and different.
Yeah. Both the spiritual and material worlds are simultaneously one with and different from Sri Hari. Simultaneously one with and different from Sri Hari. So who can cite...
Can you repeat that again?
Material and spiritual worlds are simultaneously one with and different from Sri Hari. And who can give evidence from the Bhagavad Gita about this? You know where Krishna discusses this kind of has achintya bheda bheda tattva in Bhagavad Gita. You know? Rakshit Prabhu, you got it? Chapter 9. If you all look in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 9, starting with, look at chapter 9, verse number 4. Mayatam idam sarvam jagadavyaktamurtina matstani sarvabhutani na chaham teshvavastitaha. By me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is not perceivable through the gross material senses. It is said, Atashi Krishna namadi nabhaved grayam indriyai sevon mukhihi jivadao swayameva spuratyada, from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1.2.234. Lord Sri Krishna's name, fame, pastimes, etc. cannot be understood by material senses. Only to one who is engaged in pure devotional service under proper guidance is he revealed. In the Brahma Samhita 5.38, it is stated, who knows the verse? Go ahead. Premanjana churita bhakti vilochanena santaksadeva hrdayesha vilokayanti yam shama sundara machintya gunaswarupam govindamari purusham tamaham bhajami. Come on Saturday morning at 7:30 a.m. We recite the whole Brahma Samhita. One can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda, always within himself and outside himself if one has developed the transcendental loving attitude toward him. Thus, for people in general, he is not visible. Here it is said that although he is all-pervading, everywhere present, he is not conceivable by the material senses. This is indicated here by the word avyaktamurtina. But factually, although we cannot see him, everything is resting in him. As we have discussed in the 7th chapter, the entire material cosmic manifestation is only a combination of his two energies, the superior spiritual energy and the inferior material energy. Just as the sunshine is spread all over the universe, the energy of the Lord is spread all over the creation, and everything is resting in that energy. Yet one should not conclude that because he is spread all over, he has lost his personal existence. To refute such an argument, the Lord says, I am everywhere and everything is in me, but I am aloof. For example, a king heads a government which is but the manifestation of the king's energy. The different governmental departments are nothing but the energies of the Lord, and each department is resting on the king's power. But still one cannot expect the king to be present in every department personally. That is a crude example. Similarly, all the manifestations we see and everything that exists, both in this material world and the spiritual world, are resting on the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The creation takes place by the diffusion of his different energies, and as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Vishtabhyahamidam Kritsnam, he is everywhere present by his personal representation, the diffusion of his different energies. Now, the next couple of verses are important also. Nachamatstani bhutani pashyame yogam aishvaram bhuta brinna cha bhutasto mamatma bhuta bhavanaha. Translation, and yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. Text 6. Yatakashastito nityam vayu sarvatrago mahan tatasarvani bhutani matstani tupadaraya. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. And finally, Sarva Bhutani Konteya Prakritim Yanti Mamikam Kalpakshe Punastani Kalpadau Visrajamyaham. O Son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature, and at the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I create them again. So Krishna is both the spiritual and material worlds are simultaneously one with and different from Sri Hari. What's another basic teaching of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? You want to hear them all again? Yes? Okay. Sri Hari is the supreme absolute truth. He is omnipotent. He is the nectarian ocean of transcendental mellows. The living entities are his separated parts and parcels. The conditioned souls are controlled by Maya, whereas the liberated souls are free from Maya. Both the spiritual and material worlds are simultaneously one with and different from Sri Hari. Devotional service is the only way to obtain the goal of life, and love of God is the ultimate goal of life. Got it? We didn't talk about how he is the nectarian ocean of transcendental mellows. So everyone has is eager for some kind of a rasa in this world. We can argue, I think very successfully, that people work hard in this life so that they can enjoy these rasas. Like today on the 4th of July, starting early in the morning, I saw people were out stationing themselves in the park near where I live, Washington Park. I was there at about 5:30 in the morning, and there were people that already had their picnic baskets to claim the table, because it would be full with picnickers today, right? And who would they bring to the picnic with them? They just come alone and sit there by themselves, right? Each table, there's only one person, correct? At a picnic? Is that a nice picnic? Why not? Why can't you just sit by yourself? Everyone really quiet, don't say anything, and just sit there by yourself. Is that a nice picnic? What's a nicer picnic? Add some more to it. What else? Who would you bring?
You would need some personal interaction. You would need friends and people. And the joy or the happiness that they are seeking in the relationship they will have with them.
Who would they bring? Give us an example.
They will essentially invite family and friends.
Family define, which kind of family?
Well, it will be their children or parents, their friend circle in society, and they may even invite their co-workers from work to come to the picnic.
And all of those have, there's a different relationship with each one, right?
Yes, correct.
So they bring their mom. Why? Would it be fun to bring mom along to that? Maybe.
Why not?
Depends, right? Yeah, if you love your mom, and so you could show off to your mom, look, I brought my new car, and, you know, look at my kids, they're so nice, and it's a rasa, isn't it? There's a taste in that. Otherwise, why do it? And then your friends, too. Why do you bring your friends along? Arjuna said it in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. He said, if I kill all these people, who am I going to show the kingdom to? Right? He said, so what's the use of this war? All the people I want to show the results of my winning the war, if I kill them, who am I going to enjoy it with? Right? So everyone wants some rasa, some exchange. They come to the picnic, they bring their mom, they bring their kids, and then the kids, they have a rasa too, right? Sure. They bring along their friends and everyone. So there's friends, there's mother, father, then there's pets. There's different kinds of rasa. So in the spiritual world, those rasas are all there too. There's the shantaras, which is just a great appreciation for the power, the awesomeness of the Supreme, the shantaras. And it's a passive kind of relationship. And then comes what's another kind of rasa? Dasya, which means? So there's a feeling of that moves me, moves my hands and legs, some kind of gratitude where I want to do some service. I want to do something. So is that going on at the picnic? Someone's doing the serving? Some dasya ras? Everyone pitches in. Someone's serving. Oh, this is some rasa there, right? And then what other kind of rasas are there? Sakya ras. That's definitely there at a picnic, right? What would you do with sakya ras at a picnic? Express it. You play some games. You know, someone brings a frisbee or a football and they throw back and forth and they joke around. They maybe wrestle with each other or something like that, right? Talk about old times. Sakya ras. Then? Vatsalya ras, which is parental. So what's that at the picnic? They're feeding the kids. They bring all the food, right? And they're admiring their children, how they're getting strong, running around. Oh, how he's grown, all this kind of feeling, right? There's Vatsalya ras. And Madhurya ras, any of that at a picnic? Yeah? Where does that come in? Bring the girlfriend, bring the boyfriend, and then there's, you know, you're having that. Oh, please have a seat. And you can move up close if you like to. So, oh, good. Are we having Sankirtan now? Okay. Are the everyone's ready to go right now, or just Srikant? I mean, not that there's just Srikant. Srikant's a force unto himself, but... Okay. So we have availability, we have sunlight, we have a nice 4th of July. We have an opportunity for anyone who would like to experience another kind of rasa, which is the Sankirtan rasa. And all weekend long, devotees have been going out door to door. We went out yesterday, had a very nice experience. The first two doors we went to. First door I knocked on, the man was, we had 7 devotees with us, I believe. So he opened the door and he saw 7 of us. And I could hear he was listening to some sporting event inside his, it turned out to be the World Cup. I think that's still going on, right? So that I could hear the roar of the television, and he was kind of half leaning out the door like he wanted to get back to the game. So I was talking to him, and we showed him the Bhagavad Gita and explained the whole thing to him. And he was very accommodating. He gave a donation, $10 donation, and took the Bhagavad Gita, and he chanted the Maha Mantra. And he happily went back to his game. And take the mic. Start over.
Oh, okay. So Nina and I knocked on another door, and this girl looked out from the patio, and she saw us, and she started jumping, and she said, "I was looking forward to you people coming to my house." And she was an Indian from Bombay, but she had some relatives who were in the movement, but still she wanted to know what we are doing and about our philosophy and everything. So she was so happy to see us knocking her door, and she was like. Then she asked us about how you were benefited by chanting, and I mean about our experience and everything. So she took our details.
So what did you tell her? How she benefits from chanting?
How did I?
Did she ask?
Was she
you?
Asking me how I benefited from?
She asked you chanting. How she benefits from chanting.
And also,
what did you tell her?
I told her that I'm in the initial phase now, so I'm now becoming more introspective. I mean, like kind of being aware of many. My motives when I do things, I kind of introspect a lot, and then so I'm in that phase. Then slowly, I'm hoping to become better by that. So I'm also trying to be more objective. Like people don't affect me so much like they used to affect before. Like if somebody at work also sometimes when somebody is like when I face situations, I feel like I'm able to be more calm and not get agitated a lot.
Wow, that sounds consistent with what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. That these qualities, like he says, the prasriya priyam prapya nodvijet prasri prapya chapriyams dira buddhira sammudho janati brahmavid brahmanistitaha. That a person who's situated in Brahman, they're not disturbed when there's pleasing or displeasing things that come their way. So by your chanting, you're becoming more equipoised.
Better than, yes, more.
Yeah, you're improving. You can feel it. So that's what you told her.
Yeah, that's what I told her. And she could see that. And then, I mean, she could...
Appreciate.
She could appreciate that. And then, so she said she would come to the temple sometimes. She took a Gita and small books.
Bravo.
She said she would read them. And it was a nice... Neela was there too. And it was good.
Very good. This fulfills what Prabhupada said in his poem when he was sitting in Vrindavan. He wrote a poem called Vrindavan Bhajan. And in that poem, he says that people all over the world, they're sitting in their homes and they're looking down the lane wondering, when are Nitai and Gauranga going to come and save me? So they're eagerly awaiting. So you're coming as their representative.
Thank you, Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.
So going door to door is a very nice rasa. You knock on the door, you feel a little bit of excitement because you don't know who's going to answer the door. And then when they open the door, then you express your appreciation and gratitude for their opening the door. And you can introduce yourself and whoever's with you. This is what I do. I feel before they open the door like I'm coming home to meet my best friends or family. And they're all inside the house. So I build up that feeling. And when I knock on the door, I'm building it up. And they open the door and say, hi, as if they're my long-lost friends or relatives. And then I show them that I just introduce myself and whoever's with me and ask them who they are. And then I tell them that we're showing these books and I show them the Bhagavad Gita. And it's very fun. So we have a program on Sundays during our monthly Sankirtan festivals called Sankirtan Sunday. And there's availability for anyone who would like to go out to watch this door-to-door. There's expert Sankirtan devotees ready to go out. They're in the parking lot now with books. And they go about 10 minutes away from here. There's an apartment area that is where people are simply looking down the road waiting for us to knock on the door. That's the apartment areas that we pick particularly. And then the devotees go out for about 1 hour and come back here in time for the last part of the kirtan and prasadam. You don't miss anything. So if anyone feels like going out, especially if you haven't gone out during the monthly Sankirtan festival so far, we have a goal of 300 devotees going out for book distribution this month. And the festival is, and the ultimate culmination of this whole thing is coming up next Sunday. So if you feel like it, we'll take a 5-minute break before the artik ceremony. And anyone who's curious, you can just poke your head outside the door, and the devotees who are ready to go can tell you about what's involved. And Manju, are you going back out?
Yes,
ma'am. Oh, so you'll see, you'll have Manju is one of the expert guides and experienced Sankirtan devotees. This is the power team. You get to go out with the power team. We'll take you door to door. They're very experienced in Sankirtan and expert at how to do it, deal with it. You can just go watch them. You can ride shotgun and watch how they do it. And it's a nice experience, and you'll be back here in about an hour, so you have that choice. So, sure, why not? Everyone who feels like it, just go take. Okay, excellent, great. So we're going to take a 5-minute break, and so everyone can get up. We'll put all the books away and all the asans. Everyone who wants to go out for the Sankirtan, just go ahead, and Manju will help organize you, put you in a car, and take you out. And anyone who wants to stay here will have an artik ceremony, and we'll greet the Sankirtan devotees when they come back in about an hour, and then we'll all have prasadam together, okay? Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur ki jai, Goprema Nande Haribo.